Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with wildlife traffickers pushing some species to the brink of extinction, we explore the multi-billion dollar a year industry. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done to rescue our most endangered species? But first, the battles and the changes arising from the so-called disruptors, such as Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb. We're joined by Sarah Kane. She's associate professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia, and she's been studying the global phenomenon of the so-called sharing economy. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Sarah Kane. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you've been writing for this publication, The Conversation, about how this so-called sharing economy has been shifting and changing. Your latest piece about that part of it, like Uber, the ride sharing, the task rabbits, this end of it that deals with so-called independent contractors. I thought perhaps what we should start with is kind of a big picture about how these new emergent companies like Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, all of these, how are they changing the economy?
All of the companies that you've listed, that you've named, are really about changing how services are delivered. And the good thing about them, the attractive thing about them, is the immediacy. And so in a world where we're used to things being immediate, we're used to, you know, cutting through the middlemen and getting the things we want quite quickly, these types of services provide that. So Uber, you know, you directly contact a driver. Airbnb, you directly contact the providers of your accommodation. So as consumers, we're very attracted to this and the immediacy of these services. Now, not all of the companies are the same in terms of how they deliver their service. So some still rely on workers to deliver those services, whereas others, it's not such an issue. Say with Airbnb, there's a different kind of regulatory set of concerns rather than sort of labour standards or labour issues, if you like. So not all participants in the sharing economy are the same for a start. And often that's with perceived benefit to consumers. The downside of that is that these disruptors often don't regard and respect existing regulations, which have come about historically to protect either consumers or workers or other participants in the economy. So there's both up and down sides to this idea of disrupting the traditional way we consumed goods and services.
So one of the aspects of this that you're talking about, the disruption that other scholars have also talked about, deals with how we're moving to this independent contractor sort of society where people are working all the time, not getting to take holidays, not getting the kind of benefits they're used to having whenever they work for a company for a long time. And then on the other side of it, which you've also written about, deals with how do you regulate these things? We've had these regulatory structures that have been in place to protect, like you mentioned, consumers, people who would use the services, as well as workers. This new model has been working outside of these legal paradigms, so to speak, up until more recently. You've been tracking some of the changes, so why don't you elaborate on what's happening here and how the battle has been ensuing?
You started there by talking about, I guess, independent contracting and how these services are based on this idea of a very flexible workforce that sort of dip in and out of providing these services as suits them. And there's something quite attractive about that for some people, that they can, you know, use excess resources, excess time to get some extra work and make some extra money. The problem with that is increasingly people are relying on this kind of work as their main form of work. And it takes us back to sort of pre-regulation of the labour market, if you like. So the time before we had minimum standards. And so that's the danger, that this kind of system erodes what has been built up for legitimate reasons. So that's the first part of it. I guess the second part in terms of what has been happening is that there's been a level of engagement between stakeholders, regulators, and these sharing economy type operators. But the most obvious case, the most publicised case, has been that of Uber. And Uber has quite deliberately and overtly said that it's prepared to circumvent pretty much any regulation that interrupts with how it wants to provide its service. There's been different responses from regulators around the world. So we know in France, very recently, the managers of Uber in France have been prosecuted over this kind of flagrant flouting of regulation. But in Australia, in some jurisdictions, we've had a sort of tentative step towards including Uber into a regulatory framework. Now, that's okay to a degree, but we've also seen people on the streets protesting against what they see is Uber's means of operation. So it's kind of multi-layered. You have the formal regulation, which has been varied across the world, and then you have, I guess, the enforced regulation, which is workers deciding whether or not they think what's happening is fair, and that's where we've seen protests by Uber drivers and by regular taxi drivers against what they see as unfair practices of Uber.
You'd mentioned in one of your articles earlier some of the other countries. Just now you mentioned France, but you also have written about what's happened in Hong Kong, for example, and in South Korea, also in India. Can you give us some ideas of what's been happening in these countries?
It has been a bit mixed. One interesting trend, if you like, is that in some of these countries, local competitors, often supported by the state or by other companies, have emerged to compete with Uber. So while Uber was out front and attempting to get to break into markets and based their expansion strategy on that, their approach has not necessarily been without issues in the terms that it's been backfired to a degree that states, governments have said, well, we're not sure that this is the right way to go. What can we do to support competitors? So in China, there's been some local competitors in India. Now, they haven't had the traction that Uber has yet, but there's certainly been this development of this competition in terms of ride sharing, which Uber may have predicted, but may not have predicted rolling out in the way that it has.
You mentioned some legal issues. I think South Korea was one where you said there were 30 people charged with running an illegal taxi firm. There was, I think you mentioned in the same article, about in Hong Kong, where these drivers were arrested for illegally hiring out their vehicle. And then, of course, we've got the legal fights going on in, say, Los Angeles and Seattle. Can you tell us a little more about those?
So just to carry on a little bit, in Australia as well, we've had in various jurisdictions Uber drivers prosecuted for not complying with regulation. So it's been a very mixed, again, at multi-level. So it's often the drivers who are the ones that are prosecuted because they're the ones that can be found actually flouting a law. So Uber isn't necessarily the one that's in the firing line, although certainly it's been Uber's practice to cover fines and legal costs of drivers to date. Although in Australia, we've seen Uber, it has said it will cover fines, but hasn't actually done so, hasn't actually put up the money in some cases. So the other cases are really about, again, because of the way that Uber's been operating, the regulatory issues are also multifaceted. So there's tax issues, there are labour regulation issues, there are safety issues. So in terms of the legality or the potential areas of risk for Uber as a company, it's not just labour law that it's sort of coming up against and facing cases and prosecution about. It's also areas to do with, you know, the safety of consumers. In Australia, there's been concern, there's been a subject of an ongoing Senate inquiry about tax evasion by big companies like Uber. So we have the sort of more prominent cases we know in California of drivers making the argument that they are not independent contractors, that they are in fact employees, and that's an ongoing case that Uber has been challenging through the process. Again, if Uber has taken a decision, and their CEO has been quite open about this, to take on any regulation, whether it's labour law, whether it's to do with safety of consumers, whether it's to do, they're going to take it on. Now, in some cases, they've accepted, you know, some form of regulatory oversight, as in Australia, because the regulators have also moved. But certainly their approach has been, and their strategy has been, we will take on and challenge existing frameworks everywhere that we go. And the onus will be on other people and regulators and governments to make us do this. We will not voluntarily comply with anything that exists.
So they really almost model a Wild West type of work environment, everybody on his own.
That's a fantastic analogy. It is the Wild West. And their argument is very much, this is uncharted territory. This is, you know, this is the Wild West. There is nothing here before us. This is their argument, that there has been nothing here before us in this space. Therefore, we get to determine what happens. Now, the implications of that for organisations, for how we deal with corporates, is frightening. That's what we assume is okay. That because something is, you know, that there's a sexy new app that's been developed, that it's okay to say, well, nothing else applies to us. Now, we've come a long way in terms of how we deal with the corporate sector in appropriate regulation. I think we've come a bit too far to accept that as an excuse from organisations, particularly, you know, large organisations that have the resources to comply. I mean, Uber is an extremely cashed up organisation.
Right. And in fact, you mentioned that Uber has been hiring some pretty high-level people for its lobbying. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. We started this conversation talking about the sharing economy. And I think it's really important that we understand that the sharing economy covers a range of participants. And so when we think sharing economy, we think of, you know, little micro-startups, neighbourhood startups, you know, working together, sharing resources, sort of being environmental and that kind of thing. Uber is a big multinational company. It seeks to minimise tax. It seeks to minimise legal obligations. And it seeks to, like other big organisations we've seen in other traditional industries, it seeks to influence and lobby decision makers. And in doing so, it has been quite strategic about employing very well qualified lobbyists, advocates, public relations people, including David Plouffe, who, of course, was very instrumental in Obama's campaigns, and Rachel Whetstone, who was the former head of Google Communications, as well as, you know, ex-chief of staff to governors, etc. So Uber is being very, very strategic about engaging with regulators to shape the environment that they would most like to see for themselves. Now, I should say, Uber's not Robinson Crusoe on this aspect, but it is behaving very much like an established, traditional corporate player, not some kind of trendy, cutting-edge, small sharing economy participant.
Now, in one case that you wrote about, which was the California Labor Commission decision, I guess it was a decision that Uber was a sham contracting. How do we distinguish what that means exactly?
In Australia, we have quite a different set of labour laws than you have in the US. So we have particular definitions of what sham contracting means. But the same theory applies wherever you are. It's a question of what kind of responsibilities do you have to the person that you're contracting to. So with regards to Uber, does Uber have control over the work of the drivers? What is the degree of that control? Do the drivers have the capacity to engage in work for others as well? But a key aspect is control. And if we think about Uber, they really performance manage their drivers quite stringently. So there's the consumer rating, if you like, of Uber drivers. So consumers, people who take an Uber car, can rate their driver. Now, Uber then determines whether that driver can keep driving for them based on those consumer results. So effectively, we're seeing quite a tight level of control between Uber and the drivers, and a performance management system akin to performance management systems you'd see, you know, in other organisations. So one of the things that's looked at, and various jurisdictions have various ways of measuring, what types of levels of control does the company have over the employee? Are there things that tie that driver or that contractor to the company that sort of makes it quite exclusive? And if we think about Uber, there's a particular app that's used, and that's how work is distributed. So there's various measures. And if these measures, depending on the jurisdiction, are found to exist, so whether there's control, whether there's, you know, sort of fairly exclusive work arrangements, that kind of thing, then it's decided, well, that worker is an employee. That's not truly independent. It's at least dependent contracting, and at worst, it's a sham contract.
Now, your most recent piece pertained to labor unions and in contrast to Uber and in perhaps conjunction with Uber, where you noted that there is a sort of a crisis among labor unions and so few people being members, but that there's this sort of parallel emergence among organizing with Uber drivers. So let's take a look there and how you have articulated one or two possible scenarios of labor unions learning from, working alongside, working with Uber drivers. How do you see that?
You've laid out, I guess, some of the issues for those organizations seeking to represent workers in the sharing economy, Uber drivers, etc. And labor unions around the world, well, in developed countries, have been suffering declines amongst traditional areas of work, let alone areas which are much more amorphous and difficult to get to. But what we've seen is a kind of grassroots, very organic resistance to some of the activities of Uber and other companies, organised by drivers and workers themselves, using techniques based on social media, etc., to form sort of much more, I guess, fluid collectives, if you like, than we would be used to in the traditional labour movement. Sort of the argument that we're putting forward is that unions need to be a lot more, not just receptive, because I think they would be, but a lot more alert to opportunities to work with these more fluid collectives of workers. And often existing structures of labour unions don't necessarily allow them to take advantage of or to work in coalition with these kinds of collectives as they arise, or to even be aware of them. And so we're really advocating for unions to really think about how they might be able to work. And it might be a much more temporary arrangement than we're used to, you know, than someone signing up to a union for the term of their working life. So being a lot more flexible about how they engage with workers on particular issues of importance to them. The other thing is really that we're thinking about is, so let's take Uber as an example. Uber, there are a lot of Uber drivers, and so that even accessing, you know, a small percentage of those workers through engagement with social media and other ways provides quite a basis of potential change and potential power to change organisations like Uber. So it's almost a necessity for unions to figure out how they engage because of the scale of these workforces. And things are only going to get worse for them if they really can't come to terms with that.
One of the things that you wrote about in this context was how unions have been sort of stuck in the past in terms of how they do things and the model that they use. And should they update the model, they could end up reinvigorating the entire union movement. What are some of the ways that you see that they could update their model? You mentioned social media as an example. You mentioned being more fluid. But there are some other things that you mentioned in the article as well.
The first thing is, I don't think unions will ever replace face-to-face contact with workers. I think that's what gives them, you know, detail and understanding of what's happening with workers, but it's not enough. I think we often think the easy fix is, you know, if we just get a Facebook page as a union, if we just post some tweets, then that means that we're engaging in the social media space and there'll somehow be some big organic uprising amongst our potential members. But I think unions have to become a lot more sophisticated about how they approach technology altogether. So thinking about getting people with expertise on web analytics, people who are actually monitoring what's happening out there on non-labour movement social media, engaging with it, trying to build those links with organisations and with groupings of workers that already exist. So I think, you know, developing a Facebook page, posting some tweets, yeah, okay, that's one side of it, but I think it has to be a much deeper upskilling, if you like, of labour unions to understand the power of, you know, big data, when you can get in and see what people are doing on the net, you can see how they're engaging with different types of social media. So I think it might be supplementing what have been, you know, traditional labour movement strengths of face-to-face organising with people within unions who have the skills to understand the technology much more deeply than being able to post on social media. The other thing is that And I know there are some examples in Australia, and I know unions have been trying in various contexts to also grapple with the fact that labour law actually is not where the main game is anymore. So unions have to be prepared not just to rely on labour lawyers and trying to engage with the system that already exists, but in some ways, like Uber is trying to pioneer its regulatory environment, unions, labour organisations have to think about how they shape the regulatory environment, what kinds of other legal avenues, regulatory avenues, etc., they might explore that isn't sort of in their traditional purview, and that the structure of organisations, including the sharing economy, but including franchising, including, you know, quite convoluted supply chain construction in modern organisations, mean that unions have to figure out how they regulate, what pressure points are going to be, how they leverage these new configurations of organisations and consequently of working relationships.
One of the things that you said in this last piece was to retool for a post-employment workplace.
Exactly. And that's basically the summary of what I've just said. So we no longer have workplaces looking like they used to. So what does that mean, and what do unions need to be able to do their important job, which is represent workers who aren't neatly located in a factory, in a shop, in an office, and that does require retooling.
You had written out a couple of scenarios about how you see this all playing out. Scenario one dealt with like these individual lawsuits, class actions, aggressive regulation, and what might happen there. Scenario two was Uber adopting a risk mitigation strategy. Why don't you expound on those two possible scenarios about how you see this turning out?
You know, the first scenario is that it becomes to be the aggressive approach of Uber does not make business sense anymore. That the business case for that is starting to fail because the costs are just too big, competition is increasing. And in that case, Uber decides that it needs to, it either gets knocked out from the regulators say this is not going to happen, and so Uber either has to change or die. The second scenario really is that Uber strategically looks around and sees what's happening, sees if it needs to be a bit more pliable in some situations, but really where it can keep adopting its Wild West strategy, it does. And that, of course, we know that Uber's investing in, you know, self-driving cars. That would seem to be, if from a business perspective, that would be seem to be a sensible option for Uber, and circumvents a whole lot of these issues about regulating for labour standards, as well as saving them a huge amount of money long term. I would suggest that that second scenario where Uber strategically looks around and says, well, okay, say for example in Australia, there's been some movement on regulation, we will comply with this lighter regulation. Australia's not a big market. In the meantime, we'll keep pursuing what we want to do in China, in India, in South America, in areas where, you know, we feel we can still pursue a much more aggressive Wild West strategy. And that seems to be what they're doing. And I would imagine that's what they would continue to do unless there's some very unpredicted shift in those larger markets.
One of the fights that has been going on in the U.S. is in Seattle, along with one of the Teamsters. I think it's the Local 117. Have you been following that?
I haven't been following it as closely as I might, but I do understand that the Teamsters have been trying to be quite active, particularly in Seattle.
And it sounds like what they're doing are some of the things that you have articulated that labor should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I definitely don't want to suggest that unions aren't trying to engage in this space. And the Teamsters have been promoting an app-based drivers association. So they're trying to engage in this space in a way that workers are happy and willing to engage. So I think that's something they're really trying to do. I guess as with anyone or any organisation trying to play catch-up, it's a bit harder when you're coming from behind. So the Teamsters have certainly been trying to engage in the same way that these workers who are working for Uber and other rideshare organisations are engaging with their employer. And I think that's really the way forward. So far, you know, these are quite small scale, but they certainly, you know, show what unions need to try to be doing. And I guess the difficulty in it is, you know, playing catch up after the after the event at where the organisation has already, you know, had quite a lot of time to establish. But certainly what's happening in Seattle in their attempts to engage with workers shows the way that unions need to be looking.
Sarah Kane, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I hope that we can continue this conversation because it seems to be an ever-developing phenomenon that we should continue to study.
Indeed, and thank you for having me.
Sarah Kane is Associate Professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia, and she's been studying the global phenomenon of the so-called sharing economy. When we come back, wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar per year industry. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done about it? Stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Flora Moulton, blind street singer from Washington, D.C., talks about her music and sings, "I Can't Stand It," from this 1976 WPFW interview.
I wrote this song one night. Now, I'm going to tell you something about that, my songs that I write. I write songs about myself. And I write songs about history of things then. I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
This recording is part of American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publication and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Despite efforts to preserve endangered animals, trafficking has increased in some parts of the world by an estimated 5,000%, according to conservationists. The poaching is pushing some animals, such as black rhinos and hippos, to the very brink of extinction. 46 countries signed the London Declaration, which works to end wildlife trafficking through law enforcement and cross-country cooperation. U.S. President Barack Obama has an additional national initiative that includes measures such as a ban on trafficked items like elephant tusks. Wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar per year industry that has reportedly been used to fund Al-Qaeda-related groups. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done about it? Three experts join us. David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt also joins us. She is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the scope of the problem. David Wilkie, what would you say we're facing?
Humans have been trafficking wildlife for millennia, and it's remarkable. North Americans actually ate passenger pigeons to extinction. There used to be flocks of 3 billion flying overhead, and we ate every single one of them. Well, the challenge is that we're doing this to more and more species as more and more of humanity gets to a level of wealth where we can all afford to buy things. And so tiger bones, tiger skins, leopard skins, rhino horns, elephant teeth are all trinkets that humans want for prestige or for other reasons. And with 7 billion people on the planet, demand for wildlife products is grossly outstripping the ability of wildlife to supply and meet that demand. So we're in a terrible crisis, and we're going to lose many species unless we do something about it.
As I understand it, the numbers are changing quite drastically and have become much worse, particularly with some of the animals, like you mentioned, tigers, rhinos, and elephants. Do you have a sense of how much worse it is?
Well, there's only about 1,600 female tigers left in the wild. That's a startlingly tiny amount. African elephants, we've gone from 1.5 million savanna elephants to around 300,000. We went from 800,000 elephants in the tropical forests of Africa to 80,000. So we've only got 10% of the elephants in the forests of Central Africa that we used to have. An unbelievable crash in the populations. It's very much the same way that whaling went. We lost almost 95% of our whales, and only when we found fossil fuels in Pennsylvania and started replacing whale oil for lamp oil did we actually save the whales. So we've got the ability to change the situation. We just need to have a global commitment to do so. And I think we've actually begun to see a sea change in the attitudes of the global community about wildlife trafficking. And Chelsea Clinton and Secretary Clinton have a huge amount to, we've got a lot to thank them for actually pushing the global agenda on wildlife trafficking.
Tanya Wyatt, what would you add?
Well, I do think you see geographic differences. You have problems of demand in the United States, in the European Union, also in China and other areas in Asia, such as the Southeast. But then you also see, you know, the developing the global South, we could say, as being the areas that are particularly exploited areas, obviously in Africa, South America, and again in Asia, that are targeted for their wildlife as commodities to be sold into more Western or areas that have growing middle class consumers. So there is a regional and geographic aspect to it that we need to take into consideration when we're developing prevention strategies.
Mark Bickoff.
I agree with everything that's been said. I think we need to have extremely strong enforcement of existing regulations, and maybe the existing regulations aren't really strong enough. I'm always amazed at the sheer numbers of animals who are involved. It's staggering when I read the reports of the millions of members of different sorts of species who are involved in the illegal wildlife trade. So it seems to me that enforcement is really important.
When you say millions of species, the ones we hear most about are the tigers, the rhinos, the elephants, the great apes. David Wilkie, I think you've also written about the great apes. Mark Bickoff, what are the other animals?
When I said millions of species, I was really thinking more the sheer number of individuals in a given species. But exotic birds, for example, and reptiles who can be stuck in suitcases, for example, and you know, people try to smuggle them in. So that's all I was really referring to.
I see.
This is David. I was just out in Cameroon working with some colleagues of mine to think about how we might set up a conservation agenda for African grey parrots. It never occurred to me that African grey parrots are the most valuable pet on the planet. Because every African grey goes for $1,000 to $10,000 a bird. And we know nothing about them. We don't know about their ecology. We don't know where they feed. We don't know how many there are. They're social birds. They groom one another like primates. And yet we know practically nothing about their ecology. And yet they're the single most valuable pet on the planet. Isn't that startling? And I think this speaks to me about what the trade is about. 89% of Chinese consumers of ivory know that ivory consumption requires the death of an elephant. And 85% of those consumers will say they're going to buy ivory again.
Mm-hmm.
If just 10% of Chinese families who make $16,000 or more a year buy one 2-ounce piece of ivory, that's about the size of a piece of soap that you get in a hotel. That requires 32,600 elephants to die. So the scale of the issue is unbelievable, and yet our ability to, our knowledge of the issue is waning relative to the scale of demand.
Tanya Wyatt, you have been looking at this. You've compared it also to the drug trafficking rings. You say the worst perpetrator is organized crime, but that there are other perpetrators. How would you describe this?
I would say that organized crime might have the largest impact in that they are capable of killing, frankly, more animals than maybe individuals. But you do have all the different levels of people that are actually involved in consumption and involved in demand. So you do have impoverished people that may feel forced to to poach or to harvest things illegally. But I'd argue that they're probably having the least amount of impact or killing the least amount of animals. And you do have these larger criminal organizations that may be organized or maybe just structured rather than being our kind of stereotypical mafia kind of organized crime. And those are the kinds of criminals that we need to be worried about, because they're the ones that are poaching elephants and rhinos in a very structured and systematic way.
And yet part of it, you mentioned, is also there are all these other actors that are part of the process: states, terrorists, corporations, insurgents. How do you see each of these actors as part of it?
Well, absolutely. It's certainly a long chain of middlemen that it's passing through as well. And states do have a role to play in that. There's arguably corruption is key in facilitating a good deal of wildlife trafficking, which is an area that needs to be studied much more. But corruption of customs, border patrol, police officers, but government officials as well that are facilitating it and profiting from it, that's a big part of it as well. And then there is anecdotal evidence that's becoming more substantiated that terrorists and insurgents are using wildlife, particularly ivory, sometimes timber, as a way to fund their kinds of conflict. And that, too, has a tremendous impact on the survival of these species.
This is David again, I couldn't agree more. I think that the wildlife trade and wildlife trafficking is just one other commodity that's being adopted by organized crime. They traffic arms, they traffic women, they traffic drugs, and now they're just trafficking wildlife. It's just another commodity. But to be honest, I think we've got incredibly powerful tools to tackle that part of the trafficking, the financing of trafficking. U.S. statutes for money laundering are about 20 years old, and it allows for the Treasury Department, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security to actually forfeit assets of people who we believe have gained these assets illicitly. It doesn't require the conviction of someone. It just requires the assumption that the assets have been obtained illicitly. And I think that asset forfeiture has huge potential for the U.S. and the European Union to take a bite out of crime in many ways.
In terms of the law enforcement side of things, do we know how effective these statutes are? When I worked in the legislature here, one of my first observations was we have good laws in the books, but we don't have them enforced. Is that the same situation here?
That's what I was saying, this is Mark, about enforcement. I agree that holding assets would be a very powerful tool, but it just, I don't know, maybe I'm a skeptic on it. It just seems the corruption is so widespread that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to enforce already existing regulations or laws.
This is again David. I would agree with that too. But two colleagues of mine, Sam Strindberg and Fiona Meisel, looked at 10 years of data on the changes in elephant numbers in Central Africa. The results were devastating. It was a huge collapse of elephant populations in Central Africa. And they used really credible data to show that. But the upside of that was they showed that anywhere in Central Africa where rangers were actively patrolling, elephants survived. We know that good and effective ranger patrolling is a hugely successful activity to prevent poachers coming in and whacking elephants for their ivory. Regardless of corruption, it actually works. So we know that ranger patrolling works, and the conservation community has come together and developed this new consortium called SMART, which is to try and roll out the next generation of really clever tools to help eco-guards, rangers, park service people to do patrolling the most effectively as possible. And we've got credible evidence to show that matters, that it makes a difference. Where rangers are patrolling, elephants survive. Where rangers aren't patrolling, elephants disappear. So, yes, corruption is a huge problem, but we've got some tools that can actually make a difference.
I had read that a lot of technology was being developed in a way that could also aid in the enforcement of these laws, technology that is actually controversial in other ways, such as drones. Is this actually being developed for conservation purposes, or is it just far off into the future? Tanya White?
Andrew Lemieux, another colleague of mine, and I believe that they have been actually testing drones in Uganda, is at least my sense of it. So I do think it's maybe a bit further along than we would have guessed.
This is David again. Yes, UAVs are actually really useful. And to be honest, they're useful for two reasons. UAVs or drones let eco-guards, who are typically far less sophisticated and armed than the poachers who they're against, it lets a ranger patrol figure out whether people that they're hearing at a salt lick, are they hunter-gatherers who've got legitimate reasons to be there, or are they illegal hunters who have got AK-47s and RPGs and could... So drones help rangers save themselves from getting into a firefight and actually getting killed. So I think drones have huge potential to increase the safety of ranger patrolling. And drones also have a huge potential of reaching out, allowing a ranger patrol to patrol a far larger area than they would on foot. And this is particularly important in the forest. So yes, we are actively using drones to extend the reach of eco-guards and to protect eco-guards from bumping into much more seriously armed individuals and much more ruthless individuals who are poaching ivory.
To me, then we're more on the ground, because at the beginning we were talking, you know, just about corruption and enforcement of regulations and holding assets, which I think is really a great idea as well, but I think it's really very difficult to enforce. But I love what you're talking about in terms of local types of control. When I was in Kenya, I mean, I talked to some people, and one of the points they made was, you know, in some ways the people doing this are just trying to survive, and you can pay them to kill animals or you can pay them to protect animals. And it's not that they're nasty people, it's just they're very poor and they need an income. So I'm liking the idea of, you know, acting locally and thinking globally, if you will.
Well, that brings up a case study that Tanya Wyatt did. Tanya, you did this case study about Cambodia and some of the efforts they've made there that seem to have had an element of success.
Well, I think it's similar to what Dr. Wilkie was talking about of NGOs that have been quite progressive and have years ago realized that rangers do make the difference in protecting species. And so I was an intern and have written about Wildlife Alliance, you know, fundraising and paying the salary of rangers to go in and actually do these patrols and protect these areas. And I do think that they've had some success. It's very promising of not only preventing poaching, but then also rescuing animals that have been poached and rehabilitating them and hopefully returning them to their habitats.
It sounded also that there was an education program there in Cambodia that was really teaching people about the ecology and about the need for biodiversity. Was that also part of it?
Yeah, that's a great program that Wildlife Alliance has developed there, that they have a van that they drive around to the more remote villages throughout southwest Cambodia and really focus on young people and go into the grade schools and to children that are around the age of 6 and 7 and teach them the value of conservation and biodiversity and how we need to protect our environment, which is really the age we need to be targeting to kind of change the entitlement that some people feel to consume wildlife. And so I think it's a great program, and I do think that they're showing some success after years of doing it.
I love the idea of working with youngsters. I think it's really the key, one of the big keys to the future.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about wildlife trafficking, the problem and the potential solutions. David Wilkie?
One of the interesting things is that wildlife trafficking is a destabilizing thing. It's usually outsiders coming in and taking the resources of local people. Local people don't like that. They don't like it because it's their resources. They don't like it because it increases violence and instability and insecurity, and that's not good for development. So one of the neat things that's happening as mobile phone and cell phone coverage extends is we actually have the capacity to have anonymous whistleblowing that allows for local people to say, hey, you know, I've noticed some weird stuff happening in my neighborhood. And to me, this sort of crowdsourced intelligence networks, again, have huge potential to extend the reach of law enforcement And law enforcement always sounds bad. I think of it as crime prevention. To me, if I say crime prevention, everyone likes it. If you say law enforcement, it sounds more like a fascist state. But crime prevention through crowdsourcing, to me, has huge potential of changing the game. Because local people don't want armed militias coming into their neighborhood and shooting the critters that they could potentially make a profit on through tourism or something else.
One other thing that I saw in one of your papers pertained to really the buyers of certain products. Now, this was specifically, I think, about bushmeat. But you had found that as the prices went up really high, the consumption went down quite a bit. Is there an answer on that side as well?
Well, bushmeat's a necessity for many people. It's a source of dietary protein. So that's different from a luxury good like ivory or rhino horn. So the economics of the trade is fundamentally different. When you drive the price up of a necessity, people will look for a substitute. There is no substitute for rhino horn or elephant ivory, and that's the trick. And that's why ban on sales and burning caches of illicitly harvested ivory is so important. I'm really looking forward to Tanzania burning their 122 tons of ivory. That means that ivory will not leak back into the market. Public crushing or burning of ivory sends a huge message. And I think that the Obama administration, by banning ivory sales effectively in the United States, is going to encourage China and Vietnam, the two largest consumer nations, to think really hard. Do they want to be international citizens? Do they want to be a part of the international community? And it's going to put enormous pressure on those governments to do something about the ivory trade.
Let's take a look at both President Obama's task force and also the London Declaration. Mark Beckoff, have you had some time to digest what has gone on?
Sort of. I did. I think that what has gone on is a really good move in the right direction. And I work in China a bunch with one of the Moon Bear Rescue projects, and I love the people there, but I'm not so optimistic about change there, not because the people are necessarily heartless, but just because the sheer numbers and the sheer money involved. That's what I've heard from people there working in other areas of animal protection, is that it's just so hard to get your foot in the door just because of the numbers and the money.
Tanya Wyatt?
I have followed, I read the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking coming out of the U.S., and then I was at the International Wildlife Trafficking Symposium that happened before the conference in London, and I'm encouraged that it's on the political agenda and it's finally getting attention that probably the three of us on the panel have been talking about for years. So it is encouraging. I probably would share some colleagues' reservations, though, that I worry that it could go the path of being too militarized and paramilitarized, and we have the same kind of battle that we had with the war on drugs, to where we just throw lots of money and lots of law enforcement at it, and we don't actually make the changes on the ground to provide people with alternative livelihoods and things that need to be done to really stamp out the problem. But hopefully all of that will come into play as well as efforts increase.
So you see part of the missing components as really an economic component for people to have an alternative to this process.
I do, yes. That's how we help local communities to not poach and not harvest things illegally. You've got to tackle demand. Yes, there's crime prevention, but there's also changing the paradigm of how we view wildlife can be consumed. And that's the most challenging task ahead for us.
David Wilkie, how would you assess the international community's efforts?
Now, what I'm absolutely startled is the marvelous mobilization of international interest and support for the ivory trafficking issue. I agree with everyone on the panel that we need to tackle wildlife trafficking. It's a trade good, so we need to tackle it along the commodity chain, from the source points where poaching is happening to national transit, to international transit, to the consumers. We need to tackle all the way along the supply chain. Absolutely. What we've learned with China is really interesting. We thought that we could use campaigns that have been very successful in the United States and in Europe, using movie stars or sports stars as spokespeople for the trade. When we actually interviewed Chinese ivory consumers, we said, you know, if Yao Ming, this wonderful, really tall basketball player, said, don't buy ivory, would that change your impressions? Would that change your opinions? 3% of ivory consumers said that would change their ivory purchasing behavior. 37%.
That's interesting. Yao Ming is a very strong supporter of the Moon Bear Rescue Program I work with.
And he's fantastic. He's a marvelous advocate.
Yeah.
But 37% of Chinese ivory consumers said if the government banned it, they would stop consuming ivory. 25% said if Politburo members said that it was inappropriate to buy ivory, they would stop buying ivory. I think one of the things we really need to do is understand the consumer. And we're getting a better handle on that. And we're getting to understand how we can use social media, how we can use pressure on the governments to change behavior. And that's a significant difference to 9 months ago.
Mark Beckoff, one of your edited volumes on conservation, asked a question in an important way. It said, who lives, who dies, and why? How would you answer that today?
It was in my book, Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. And there's essays in there that talk about the wildlife trade. I think individuals are making that decision. What they just said, I didn't know those data. And I think about American advertisement, you know, where LeBron James says something and the stock in a company goes either up or down significantly. I didn't know that about China. But I think the people who are making that, answering the question, who dies, who lives, who dies, and why, are really the locals. And that's why, like I said before, I'm not saying much new right now, is getting to them in whatever way. So if they can be influenced by government policy or what Politburo people say, that would be the way I go. But I also don't think that people realize that they are basically making that decision. And that's why, you know, the who dies, who lives, who dies, and why has sort of become my little bumper sticker. And when I talk to people about it in terms of other issues with non-human animals, it actually gives them pause because that's basically at issue. We are making these decisions about the lives of individual animals.
Tanya Wyatt, one of your studies also looked at how birds are being smuggled in Oceania, going from Australia to New Zealand and then getting trafficked out. Given New Zealand's reputation for actually protecting the environment and other species, does that become part of it? Are countries like Australia and New Zealand then going to have to crack down on this?
They're definitely hugely involved in the international discussion around wildlife trafficking. The John Scanlon, the current Secretary General of CITES, is Australian, and those people have been actively involved in it. And New Zealand's an interesting case because they were the first, really, to come up with a wildlife enforcement network. So they were good in predicting that this was going to be an issue. It does obviously come down to funding. They've had trouble maintaining the resources that are going to those units. But I think Australia is actually a good example because they have much stricter CITES regulations than other countries. And I think that's why, in part, why they've managed to keep their amounts of illegal trade so low. And as I've written in that article, it might be wise for New Zealand possibly to consider having stricter CITES regulations as well, and the UK as well, because it does tend to be a hub here in London for illegal trade.
David Wilkie.
The charismatic species always get the headlines. The pangolins, the seahorses, the sharks, critters that people either think are slimy or unpleasant or dangerous don't get into the headlines. And I would just like listeners to understand that the wildlife trade is rhinos and elephants and tigers, but it's a whole host of other species that are being overexploited because 7 billion people is a lot of demand. And we can no longer feed off the planet. We can no longer eat off the planet. We can no longer just take what we need. 89% of the terrestrial landscape is dominated by humans. That's a lot. Humanity has to decide if we want to save things or not. And for my children, my children's children, I want elephants to be there. I want rhinos to be there. I want sharks to be there. I want seahorses to be there. I want a future where my great-great-grandchildren get to see what I see. And thus, we need to fix the wildlife trade.
Mark Beckoff.
I agree. I'm so influenced by Ed Wilson. You know, Wilson, he had a great quote about how really ants and the insects are the animals with whom we should be concerned. And since I've studied social carnivores, I mean, I love them and they are charismatic, but he basically really has convinced me that somehow we have to have people become aware of the incredible importance of the non-charismatic animals. And, you know, there's a size thing there, too, because a lot of times they're the ones who can be put into a suitcase. You know, you can't put an elephant into a suitcase, but you can put a lot of little animals into a suitcase or into a backpack and smuggle them. So in my own work, I try to stress that, you know, especially with kids, take them on hikes and take them on walks and have them focus on the little animals who they think are slimy and ugly and, you know, the ones to whom they go, ooh, I wouldn't want that animal around me.
Tanya Wyatt.
No, I would agree with both of them, with Dr. Beckoff and Dr. Wilkie, enthusiastically, that we need to have that shift that wildlife is not just instrumentally valuable to humans, that it's intrinsically valuable and beautiful and has its own right to life.
Absolutely, Tanya. I couldn't agree more with you.
Thank you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Great. Well, thank you
very much for inviting me to join this conversation.
David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Also, special thanks to Joe Carmen for helping to produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Poet Sylvia Plath with excerpts from a 1962 radio interview.
These peculiar, private, and taboo subjects, I feel, have been explored in recent American poetry. I think particularly of the poetess Anne Sexton, who writes also about her experiences as a mother who's had a nervous breakdown, as an extremely emotional and feeling young woman. And her poems are wonderfully craftsmanlike poems, and yet they have a kind of emotional and psychological depth, which I think is something perhaps quite new, quite exciting.
Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.